Hello, everybody. I welcome to the Sunstone Town Hall meeting.
Louder!
We're driving away the people who aren't. That's okay. This is session number 266, the Sunstone Town Hall meeting. I am Laura Compton. I'm one of the co-chairs of the board at the Sunstone Education Foundation. Michael Stevens is here, or he was here, he'll be right back. He's rounding up our folks. And we've got, if you can't hear me, come up to the front row, because I need to hear you.
Oh, I just thought that if you move the mic closer, you know, more in line with your mouth, I might
get it. We're going to have a conversation here. This is not a lecture. Oh. This is a conversation. So, all right. Please come and join us. We will be talking about some of the stuff. We've got Mary Ellen Robertson here, who is our wonderful person in charge of this whole thing. And I have to be. And we've got, eventually, we're going to have a couple more folks from staff. And we're just going to let you know what we've been doing this year. We have a town hall session every time we have a Salt Lake Symposium. And that gives us a chance to let you know what's going on, to hear feedback from you, what you like, what you don't like, give us ideas, tell us what you need, what you don't need. And so with that in mind, I think we're going to have Mary Ellen, since she's here, is going to come up and let us know what she's got on her plate, tell us a little bit about some of the symposium and outreach efforts that she's been doing this year. And when she's done, then we'll pass the mic along to the next person and take lots of questions and input and suggestions and comments and complaints, whatever you have to say, whenever you feel like it. Mary Ellen. And you can use however you want.
I forgot this session was this hour until Mike helpfully reminded me that it was next. I put together a whole big program booklet and then forget to look at it again, so. All right, well, if you've been here the last day or so, I think you would agree that the 2012 Symposium is going swimmingly and fabulously well in this new location. We decided to come to the U after last year's trek to Weber State because we wanted to get back to Salt Lake. And we also wanted to expand our possibilities as far as venues go. We were in a rut, I think, at the Sheraton, and we were forced out of it. And I don't think we will take symposiums back to hotel venues unless we find ones that are A, large enough to accommodate us, and much nicer to work with. So things with this symposium have gone really well. One thing I wanted to bring up as far as projects that are in the works right now, you may have noticed that last fall we had some changes to our website and we upgraded to a WordPress based format, and so it's a little easier on the back end of things for us to make changes and do reprogramming things. But one of the casualties of this improvement was our back catalog of symposium audio recordings. They didn't make the initial trip to the new site with us, and in the process of figuring out why and what happened and what we needed to do to fix it, we realized that while we had a master list of symposium recordings that dated back to 1980, not all of the session information for each of those regional events or the Salt Lake Symposiums, not all the information was complete. So we have had a parade of dedicated volunteers coming into the Sunstone office and working on our master audio files. So wherever presenter names are missing, wherever abstracts are missing in our master list, they are going through and restoring all that information so that we will be able to eventually search on all titles, all presenters, you'll be able to say, I'm curious, how many symposium presentations has Bob Reese given? And I'll be able to type in your name, Bob, and
most people say too many.
And the thousands of hits that return. So we are in the process of addressing this particular topical gap. And since we had one of our board members basically build the infrastructure that we needed to continue adding audio files to this master list and make them available for each regional symposium and each Utah symposium every year. So we have a structure in place. It's just a matter of plugging in the back catalog to make that stuff available. We are also in the process of working out the details of a new partnership for a Sunstone podcast. And initially, we are going to be pulling from our back audio catalog and hosting some classic Sunstone sessions as part of this podcasting effort, in addition to doing some new interviews with folks who have presented at Sunstone symposiums. We want to put some new heads together, some new voices, getting them into the conversation, and so it seemed like a logical place for us to grow in that respect. So keep an eye out for things that are happening with our podcasts and audio. We also had a bit of a transition this year with regard to our Sunstone staff. Carol Quist, who is the longest serving Sunstone employee of record, 19 years, retired earlier this month, which is why you don't see her at the registration desk this time around. We do have a notebook that people can sign and leave messages for her since she wasn't able to be at the symposium this year at all because of her new projects that she's working on. So we've had some new ground at the office as far as bringing in someone to fill in temporarily and figuring out how we're going to cover that job of office manager and Jane of all trades. So just wanted to acknowledge Carol's many years of service and let you know we will continue to provide that with whoever else we are going to bring on. And I don't know, do you have any questions about symposium related stuff that I can answer? Sure.
Okay, maybe you don't have the answer. How does attendance this year compare to recent years?
We just in the last couple of years, we have been able to track, we've always been able to track pre-registration pretty easily. And one of my proudest moments as a Sunstone staffer was figuring out how to make our database track on-site registration. And for many years I was a board member and we would always ask the business manager, well, how many people signed up on site? How many people actually came, bought a ticket to something, registered for the whole thing? You know, can we get a head count? And he would always say, well, we can kind of guesstimate, but we aren't really sure. And so as part of fine-tuning, the different processes in the office, I figured out how to make a new entry in the database to track on-site registration and enter all those transactions the same way we do pre-registration. So it was a truly triumphant geek moment for me. I figured out how to make it do this. The CPA who worked here for 7 years didn't figure it out, and I did. So I was very happy about that. And so we have been tracking on-site attendance and pre-registration. And this year's pre-registration, we probably had about 45 more people sign up in advance than we did last year. And ever since 2008 and people's financial situations are a little bit more precarious, and this is affecting conferences all over, it's not just Sunstone, but people tend to not pre-register, they'll kind of hang on to their money a little longer and decide closer to the event that they're going to come, which as an event planner makes me really nervous. And last year I sent a panicked messages to the board saying, we haven't broken into triple digits yet for pre-registration, and it turned out fine. We did, by the time we closed registration, break into triple digits, but it was a little bit of a nail biter last year. And so this year, since we were in the office working on the final program, we just left the links up to pre-registration until I got to the office this past Monday. And so we took people's registrations over the phone, and so we were able to scoop up a few more people who wanted to attend workshops and just hadn't gone online. And so that gave us, we were one registration shy of the goal that I had for pre-registration. So it was a pretty good number. And we've had also some good on-site registration here, and I'll have to talk to the accountant and we'll do all the paperwork processing in the next couple of weeks to see what the actual on-site attendance is. So I'm glad that now we have a way to track that so we can measure how far we're reaching, what methods of publicity are getting to people, how they're hearing about the symposium. And this year we did a little extra marketing that was tied in with the Motherhood issue 166 of the magazine. And since it represented some really strong work in Mormon women's studies, I sent it out to basically all my old colleagues from the Women's Studies and Religion program at Claremont. I sent it out to all of my fellow students from that program who were still doing work in academics and anybody I could find. Plus, we sent it out to some major media outlets across the U.S., ones who have done a lot of coverage of Mormon issues during the Mormon moment, so we figured we'll strike while that iron is hot. And we've ended up with some good coverage in local papers. We've got a couple of writers for Salon.com who are here at the symposium. Through this blitz to publicize the Motherhood issue, we also inserted information about the symposium because we figured, well, let's hit them with both things. And through that extra bit of marketing, we found out that my thesis advisor from Claremont, who's now at the University of California, Santa Barbara, happened to be coming to Utah for one of their summer institute programs. They were bringing scholars who were doing work in comparative religions to Utah to tour Temple Square and the Church History Library and all these, you know, mothership kinds of things. And so she's been here at the symposium the last couple of days. She came to the Mark Silk Lecture, which was here this afternoon, and bumping into all the Mormon studies scholars that are, you know, good for her to meet in person and know. And so it was, you know, kind of this extra synergy of things that were happening all at the same time. So it's brought a lot of additional exposure, I think, to this year's symposium. Plus, the topic, I think, was of interest to perhaps a wider circle of people than we typically actually physically mail announcements out to. So people were seeing it on our website. The focus on politics brought in a good number of new presenters. As we were reviewing the pre-registration list, I kept going down the list and saying, there are a lot of people whose names I don't recognize. You know, there are a lot of, you know, old faithfuls who have registered in advance, but a lot of new people, and that's really exciting to see that we're reaching out to a new group and bringing in new people either through our topics or through our outreach efforts or through the relationships that we build at these kinds of in-person events. Because I don't think anything really substitutes for, you know, walking down the hall and bumping into Mike Quinn or Bob Reese or Margaret Toscano. So I may be a little biased on that one, but, you know, it's always been kind of a, you know, a highlight of Sunstone to meet the people who were writing the articles that interested me personally and academically and to get to know them as scholars and people. So I think that's one thing that really makes the symposium a dynamic, interactive experience. And, you know, you get to feel the community that's here. Yeah.
You announced that the next year's is going to be back in Ogden.
Yes,
what are you thinking about the location, things like that, and assessment?
All right, question on the location for next year. Ogden, we were forced into finding a new venue last year, and there was a lot.
Is that the Sheraton?
Yes, the Sheraton. Yeah, we're still wrangling with them trying to get dancers. They canceled our contract to service a larger, more lucrative group. But they said they loved us and valued our business and the long relationship that we had as they were throwing us under the bus. So, yeah. So anyway, so the Weber State event planners were very responsive to us in this crisis situation and were able to provide us with most of their largest meeting space. They did have another group in at the same time, which will not be the case next year. So we will be able to use pretty much the same space in the union plus a couple of extra ballrooms. And some of the advantages of being at Weber State, one big one on the event planner end of things is that all of the AV technical support is included in the price of renting their meeting rooms. And when you do that at hotels, if you don't bring in your own equipment, that's where they make a lot of money on conferences. And so shifting to university campuses instead of hotels is saving us money by doing that. And I think that's a good, responsible stewardship direction for us to be going in. Because we do rely fairly heavily on donations and support from our constituents. And the events generally will cover their own expenses. By the time we closed pre-registration, we had enough in the bank to cover the expenses for this event. So that was a nice, comfortable place to be.
Mary Ellen, is it possible, I mean, obviously there are balancing pluses and minuses. I'm just wondering if it's possible as part of negotiation with a hotel to include that for a long-term contract to include the use of the audiovisual limit so you're not having to pay separately. That is, is that a possible negotiating point?
It's possible, but I don't know how many concessions we would be able to get from the hotel since that is one of their money makers. And one of the advantages of especially Weber State, since their union has been renovated so recently, they have all the AV equipment built into the room, so they aren't having to push in carts. It's all right there. And having a tech support, you know, where you can just call and have them troubleshoot problems is really helpful from an event standpoint because our AV staff is very good, but they're volunteers and they're working in the back and they're the back office and processing audio. And so they're trying to, you know, address lots of different issues and stay on top of 5 and 6 concurrent sessions happening at a time. And so to have the extra support as part of what we get by renting that venue is really huge for us from a logistical standpoint.
Have you done a survey to find out what the participants, the attendees, feel about that distance from Salt Lake?
Yeah, we did a survey last year, and probably about half and half people were pretty evenly split between saying, I want to stay in Salt Lake, I don't want to go anywhere else. And people who, you know, took that leap of faith with us and went to Weber and said, hey, I really liked it, it was nice. You know, I could go outside and it wasn't just an asphalt parking lot. You know, there were things to do and places to entertain kids, and they appreciated, you know, the amenities that were there. So we are also doing a survey this time around to ask people how they feel about this venue. Parking, I know it was kind of a trick to figure out where Lot 24 was, and we ended up purchasing some additional signage to help direct traffic a little bit better to where we had reserved parking for our attendees. One of the things that we run into, especially in Salt Lake, is there are a very small number of hotels that can accommodate a group of our size when there are 5 and 6 concurrent sessions happening at once. And if you don't get on a hotel's calendar early enough, they might have space Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and have somebody's class reunion booked in their ballroom or main room on a Saturday night. And so, you know, to get a reservation for enough space, you have to start really early. And I know for a number of years, there was a multi-year contract with the Sheraton. And that's something I'm willing to look into with venues that would be large enough to accommodate us. But there aren't a whole lot in that category, unfortunately. So
part of the answer is that the way hotels make their money on their conferences is not by renting the rooms. That's essentially their business model. That's the last year. So for people like Sunstone who come in, we only want the room, and we don't have the bar service and buy all the audiovisual support, things of that nature.
And they want a minimum of 50 or 100 rooms.
Yeah. And when we go in, we say, no, 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 we just want the rooms. They go, and their response, that they don't say explicitly, but essentially they say, all you want is our last leader. We'd rather have other people. And if we start talking about, well, then what's the package deal, all of a sudden the anchor point at which you're negotiating is this other huge number, which is the full package. So the short answer is that hotels are the least desirable option. A venue like here at the university, except for the fact that, you know, we don't have the hotel rooms nearby, although guest houses work out pretty well. You're not just taking the elevator up to your room in the Sheraton for people coming out of town, but a lot of people aren't coming from out of town anyway, in which case a venue like the university here is a very comfortable choice. The question is, would an even more comfortable and accommodating venue in Weber State be worth the extra 45-minute trek for people around town?
One of the questions I would raise, and this is if I didn't have transportation last night, there was no place to eat. I couldn't get off campus. Probably the other night, at the one eating place up flight to the coast of guest house closes at 7 or something like that. But certainly, to reach my other question is, are there any other possibilities besides hotel and university?
Well, have you guys considered, for example, being much more selective about which talks you allow, and it's reducing the conference to like 2 tracks or 3 tracks instead of 4. That's just a thought.
Yes, we have.
That's completely different topic.
No, not at all. It's totally related, because if you only have to rent 2 rooms instead of 4, suddenly your costs are very different, right? That's just ways of making the...
Yeah, it can change how much we pay, but...
It also changes the dynamic.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it obviously there are many variables we're tweaking here, but I'm just saying that that's one thing to consider is that you could spend a little more money on fewer rooms, and you know, and then also you have fewer things to have to juggle, right? Because you don't have to book the whole hotel. You know, it's just.
But going back to my question, are there any other possibilities besides hotels and university?
There are a few freestanding conference centers. There's one in Ogden downtown. There's one in
Davis.
The Davis Conference Center where MHA is happening next year.
Southtown.
And Southtown. Yeah, and so I know Fair has traditionally been the first weekend in August for a number of years, and sometimes Sunstone coincides and sometimes for the week after, the week before. But there are some other options, and it takes some boots on the ground to go check them out and see whether or not they're going to provide adequate space, parking, amenities, and how much the overall cost is. Because ballpark, what we got in the estimate for this venue, the base price was about $6,000. And there were extras like signs for the parking, putting a moratorium on the parking lot just for our attendees so people wouldn't get ticketed. And the food service and things like that are extra. But our base with the Sheraton started at $8,000. For the meeting room rental and the food and beverage minimums. And on top of that, we also have to fill a certain number of sleeping rooms in the hotel, or we would get financially penalized for that. So that was one of the balancing acts of, are we going to be able to, even though they would give us a discount on their rooms, the hotel rooms are still pretty pricey if you're staying three or four nights altogether. And, you know, we're trying to make Sunstone affordable, especially for students, especially for people who are coming in out of town, and trying to keep, you know, those costs minimized while still giving people a good experience. And so these are some of the behind-the-scenes things that I'm considering and balancing. And one of the things that appeals about Weber State is they are able to make low-cost dorm rooms available for rental, and the process is self-serve online, and that's what we did last year. People could book a single dorm room for $20 to $19 a night.
That's not a possibility here.
Well, it is a possibility, but what I discovered is that the university conference planners don't handle that. They say, okay, if you want to rent dorm rooms during the summer, we want 50% of the money for those dorm rooms up front. Tell us how many. We want 50% of that value up front, and the balance you have to pay 30 days before the event. And
you manage all the keys.
Yeah, we had to be in charge of all the logistics and taking people's reservations, and given our small staff, that was just not going to happen. And so Weber has it all automated, it's all online, and they are in the process of, they've built, I think, two new dorm facilities on their campus, and a third will be done by next summer. And so everything is within walking distance. There are restaurants across the street from campus. And one thing that we didn't do last year that I think would be a good idea next time around, whether we're at Weber or whether we come back here in 2014, which they're kind of, you know, they're wooing me on that one. But we can do additional food service in the evenings after the food court closes. And so we could have people buy, and we did this last year at Weber where there were meal packages. You could buy a breakfast, a lunch, and then people were kind of on their own for dinner. But we could provide, you know, pre-purchased food service for those who want to eat something convenient, tasty, that's close by, and not have to necessarily leave campus.
The bottom line, though, is that all of these are options that we never close the door on. And at the same time, there's also some comfort in having a predictable routine. So for years, everybody knew it was the Salt Lake Shore. And now, kind of, we're hoping the new normal will be every other year, University of Utah, Weber State, kind of a routine. But we've not set that in concrete.
I drive from Utah County. I was one of the ones that kind of said, I got to drive to Ogden. And I actually probably, I don't know if I feel that story or not, I can't remember, but I came away liking it and thinking that's nice, it wasn't so bad, and that I liked it there. But it was a burden for me to hurdle and jump over to get there. And so I don't know how to communicate that to people, but I'm sure the attendance suffered from people from Utah County because of that.
Well, and we also picked up a lot of people from northern Utah because it was suddenly closer to them for the first time, I think, ever.
So. What was the enrollment as opposed to the year before at the Sheraton?
I would have to crunch the numbers on that. I don't know offhand.
I think the estimate was about 20% higher.
Higher?
You know, than the year before?
Than the year before, sure.
You see yourself going to the Valley at all?
I had somebody ask whether, and I don't know whether they were joking or not, if we could do this at BYU sometime. And I don't know if BYU would have us. I guess it, you know, don't ask, don't get, right? If you can tell me now. But
you're maybe where the game is more logical.
UVU?
Yeah.
The probability convention center.
They have, yeah. It's I believe it's completed now. Yeah, that's something I'd be willing to check out. And part of the planning cycle is that we try really hard to have next year's dates confirmed by the final program. And so if that involves a new venue, like it did last year, I had to make site visits in the middle of the symposium planning to say, okay, is the U going to be a good venue for 2012? You know, I have to go check it out. And there's only so much you can learn by looking at their building layouts and stuff online. It really helps to eyeball it and see, is this going to work? Do we have areas that are wheelchair accessible or walker accessible for people who have a little bit more trouble getting around? And so July 31st through August 3rd. So
I would go for moving it between Ogden, Salt Lake, and Utah County,
rotate all three.
Because I think you're right. People came from northern Utah to move, and now normally come. And I think that will also be true for people in Utah County, and maybe you enlarge the whole pool of potential attendees or attendees.
I'm open to that.
I'm just wondering. I didn't catch the very beginning, so I don't know if I'm not following protocol now, but when are questions, other questions?
I threw it over for questions.
Oh, okay.
When I was done kind of hitting some of the
points. We're going to have symposium reported questions, magazine reported questions, then we're going to have a giant free-for-all at the end.
So we haven't had magazine yet.
Go to magazine.
Yeah. So if you have specific feedback or things that you'd like to see happen with the Utah Summer Symposium, grab one of the green, bright green survey sheets and fill it out and let us know. So that way we can take into account the feedback and the new ideas. Because I've been doing this for 4 years, and two of those years were at the Sheraton. And once I figured out how that worked, it was really easy to stay in that rut. And I think, you know, on the one hand, you balance the familiar, usual, smooth-running machine with saying, well, how can we improve this? Can we do better somewhere else, still provide the level of service that our constituents have come to expect, and still put on a great event and rethink some of the ways that we do that? So I'm happy to take ideas and
work with those.
So if you are still talking about the symposium, can I raise one other suggestion? So, and I'd be happy to write it up as well. But,
sure.
One thing that I observed, having attended a lot of tech conferences and I used to run a business filming tech conferences across the world, and I know that Sunstone tends to be a very academic crowd, so I already was aware that it was tended more in this direction, but I'm still struck by how many people here don't understand the difference between a paper and a presentation. And I just really feel like the conference could be so much better if people knew how to give presentations.
Let's talk after.
And I would be happy to give a presentation on how to give presentations.
let's talk after.
I don't consider myself an expert, but I have learned quite a bit. And
I think that would be really useful. And one of the things that came out of a town hall meeting, I think 2 years ago, was someone who had worked in theater and said, you have to get really close to this microphone in order to be heard. And we had constituents who were saying, I go, I try to listen to the session, I sit up front, and I still can't hear you tell people how to do this more effectively. And
do you hear this echo even in this room?
It's terrible.
We didn't have that when we were saying.
Yeah.
Is this turned up all the way?
I don't know.
Part of it is presentation, but part of it I will also tell you that there are problems with the TED style approach to a symposium that I think are antithetical to a lot of the things that Sunstone's about. And we can have that discussion afterwards if you want, but there are significant serious downsides to a TED style approach.
TED style, okay. Yeah, I'd love to have that discussion with you. I don't know.
It's not a short one, but.
I'm not saying it needs to be TED, but I think anything can be, you know, it's not like an either or is what I would say.
I agree.
And it does require a skill set to do effectively. And part of what makes Sunstone so dynamic is that the presenters here don't have to have the academic credentials. So they may not have been exposed to what an academic or technical conference is like. If Mormon studies and the kind of thing they present here is something they do out of their own interests.
They know exactly what meeting thoughts are like.
What I was thinking, actually, I expected academic conferences to be much drier and more boring. So what I meant when I said academic was that that Sunstone was leaning on academic side, whereas I go to the more sort of like geeky side where lots of people are not very technical, not very grammatically correct, but are much more aware of how important it is for the audience to pay attention to what you're doing and to have some amount of visual cues, and things like that. So I was trying to say that Sunstone was very academic, but maybe...
Are you talking about papers that aren't tied to... or presentations that aren't tied to papers?
No, I'm fine with people submitting papers, but submitting a paper is different from presenting about your paper.
And that's what you...
And what I'm saying is, no one here is giving their paper, or should be giving their paper. They should be giving excerpts from their paper in a presentation style.
That isn't necessarily the view of everyone else.
Yeah. Well,
that's what you're talking about. You know your paper well enough that you can present it without having to read it.
Well, and maybe even reading it is you're just reading
time.
Yeah, why we stay, for example, is a session where you shouldn't have any slides or anything. That's perfectly appropriate. So I'm not saying get rid of those kinds of things where you're just reading to the group.
Well, let's talk out.
All right. I'm gonna pass the ball to our editor Stephen Carter.
Are you clapping for Mary Ellen? Because I haven't done anything yet.
Yes, that was from Mary Ellen.
Oh, good.
You're on trial.
We have to clarify that.
So the past year, we have seen more than these magazines. I think there were 5 magazines that were published, but we had the Approaching the First Vision magazine with amazing, luminous First Vision artwork by Galen Smith, which I thought totally rocked. Galen is one of my favorite people. And then we had a great issue that had very careless in his utterances, which was something that, what's his name? Joseph Geiser! Joe Geiser presented. And that was really fun, too. We enjoyed it. There was so much good stuff. And then we had the Motherhood issue, which shall go down in history as one of the most amazing magazines ever produced by Sunstone. And then we had the most recent Earth Stewardship magazine, which included such luminaries as Stephen Peck and Mark Thomas. And this was actually quite a compelling magazine. If you haven't read this particular one, it has some very different views. One of the authors actually argues that a very deep environmentalist mentality is embedded in Mormonism in such a way that if we in fact followed Mormonism, we would be the greenest people on earth. You should read it. It's James Goldberg's, and it's really amazing. It almost makes you say, wow, I want to be a Mormon. Save the earth. So what's coming up next? Right now I'm working on a magazine that is going to have something from Phil McLemore on sort of Mormon mysticism that's going to be very interesting. And we've got, do you remember two years ago or last year at the Sheraton when Eric Samuelson gave that presentation that just swept everybody off their feet? We're going to be publishing that. You don't remember that one? He got a standing ovation. It was great. He was pillars of my faith.
Oh.
It was great. We're finally going to be publishing that after he got out of BYU. And there's some other really great stuff. And then upcoming is going to be a magazine sort of on the intersection of literature and Mormonism. We're going to have some really interesting fiction that's already some, and one short story from Courtney Miller Santo, who just released a literary novel that is getting a lot of press. It's going to be really exciting to have her in there. And do you remember the guy who wrote... His name's Mason. His last name is Mason. He wrote that article in the New York Times about how Mormons aren't Christians. We're an Abrahamic religion. Remember that guy?
Yes. Yeah.
He's going to have an article in there, too. It's going to be on the basic premises that current scholarship is suggesting that we don't need religion for morality. So if we don't need religion for morality, what is religion for? And he argues that it's actually an art form, religion as an art form. And it's a very compelling, interesting article.
Does he use the term morality or ethics?
What's that?
Does he use the term morality or ethics?
Morality. Yeah, but that's a good distinction.
I think
that's okay, yeah, we'll talk about that. That'd be fun. And then Parker Blunt presented a very interesting paper on how fairy tales and Book of Mormon stories have a very similar structure, and he starts to tease out their similarities and how they actually work in similar ways. And I thought, that's cool. So we're gonna have that in there. And we have one more. Something from BYUI Idaho professor Jack Harrell, who has published a lot of books through Signature. He also has one. I don't remember what it's about, but it's going to be good too. So we have that one, and the one I'm currently working on. Then we're going to have one on psychology and Mormonism, which Michael J. Stevens will be in. His is on the passive-aggressive culture of Mormonism. And then we're going to have one from Adam Fisher, who did a workshop on mixed... When one spouse loses faith type thing, how do you work together to keep your marriage together? He's going to be doing something on that, and his wife, I found out, is a psychoanalyst, and she wants to do one as well. And I have one more. I don't remember what it is.
But those are the basic ones that are coming up. Psychology and Mormonism, the intersection of Mormonism and art, and sort of the rough and tumble one, the Bumbleberry one that's coming up next. It should be out in about a month and a half. Hugo, our esteemed news editor.
Steven and I work with the news section at the end of the magazine. And one issue that we always deal with is the issue of combining text with images, right? Which is, of course, a difficult balancing act. But I think that the forte of the fact that Sanskrit is a magazine format is that we can add images, right?
Definitely.
So I always tell Steve, you know, at the end, if you want to sacrifice some of the text that I wrote to add an image, you know, feel free to do so. But thinking about that, my question for Steven would be, oh, by the way, let me add this. I was at two wonderful sessions, one by Bob and one by a fellow who posted something on the logo of the Mormon Church, which are perfect. I mean, the magazine is the perfect format. Because he had this wonderful presentation of cartoons, and then the other one also very visually oriented. So my question to Steve is, to what extent, how do you do this thinking of, how can we take advantage of the fact that we have a magazine and not a journal to incorporate more images and make the images more, I don't know, more appealing?
You don't like the current images?
I love what you're doing, but what kind of, are you doing more thinking about this?
It's nice of you to bring that up. One of the things I like about Sunstone, as you say, is that we can use images, and we have so many interesting Mormon artists out there right now, and Sunstone is actually one of the few forums where Mormon artists can put their stuff, their overtly Mormon stuff, and so it gives them away, and I'm always looking for them. I'm always looking for Mormon artists who have a unique vision that we can put in our pages. And one of the cool things, even though the magazine is black and white, the app is in full, glorious, shiny color, and if you look at their stuff on that, it's just beautiful. It's an art experience to be able to see the stuff. I wish we could get that to more people. Yeah.
Yeah. Is there a graphic designer for the whole magazine?
Do you think there is?
No, it's my sense that it would be helpful to have someone whose professional work is graphic design.
Tell that to those people. I would love the graphic layout person.
I think Sunstone may be missing an opportunity to have something which is unified and within issues, and there's a design element or integrity from issue to issue. I just basing that on a long-term experience dealing with some, you know, myself dealing with graphic artists in print and feeling that there's something that could be done that would, I think, make it more appealing, especially as it's on a rack or as people, I don't know, there's a, for me, I mean, I think there's a lot of really interesting design elements of it, but I have the sense that it's not as uniform or as integrated as it could be.
I would agree with your sense. And I don't mean to marginalize or dismiss, but I guess my response is the same quote I got from someone else, which was essentially, you can buy anything in this world with money, including good graphic artists.
Well, this is my question, is are among, in the Sunstone family, I mean, one of the things I was able to do in L.A. was to get some very good graphic designers who were either in the church or in the church associated with others who could sometimes do that. So I don't know whether there's somebody within the Sunstone family who might appreciate an opportunity to let their work be shown, to have forum.
I am so wide open to that.
That's a fair challenge, I think.
Do you want to do our graphic design?
No. Yes, I love that. That would be so. To what extent is the magazine peer review?
Oh, just a second. I've got a comment on graphic design, and then we'll go to you. Sir?
Yes.
I want to say about the graphic design and the art and everything that I think, me personally, I really appreciate how it is right now because it's very open and free form, and you do something amazing every time, and it's unusual and it's different, and you don't respect the normal boundaries. Like, I understand what he's talking about, and it's very professional to feel that continuity, and it lifts it into a different category in a way. But I personally like the hippiness of the freedom of the graphic presentation, so that visually you're going into an unknown territory and anything could be on the next page, even a Japanese comic book going backwards.
By hippiness, she means she thinks you're smoking pot.
And so to me, because the content is about unusual things and things that kind of rattle your brain, then having the visual, the rich visual, because it's very rich, the rich visual, having that freedom as well, I think it's a really good, juxtaposition.
All right. Thanks.
Steve,
I understood
that
there's
a place to
kind
of...
Yeah, kind of.
It's a design. That's what it is. And then you should adapt that as needed.
Yeah, essentially, and sometimes I break boundaries, and it's all out of not being trained as a graphic artist.
What was your other question?
What is the next peer review?
Whenever I do things that are more general in interest, or like Time magazine-y, the basic editorial process is me, and then Houston Carroll, and then John Charles Duffy. And so that's when it's general interest. When it's something that's out of my expertise range, I go and I find someone who is an expert in that. So there isn't a formal process, but that's because...
So within your area, it's the three of you, and then there's something that you feel less comfortable about.
Certainly,
yeah. Send it out.
So
oh, yeah.
They don't have an editorial board of reviewers,
right? Yeah.
It's the three of them plus... It's more editor review than the traditional peer review.
Yeah, and so I understand like the dialogue has a very definite process of how things go through, and I think that's very appropriate.
Is it with fiction and poetry too, or is that another people, or is it peer review and stuff like that?
Oh, it's true. Lisa Downing is my fiction editor, and she's top notch. But yeah, like there was an article that came through the other day that was about history, and I'm not at all versed in history, so I found a few people, and I said, like, has stuff on this been published before? Is this on target? And stuff like that. And so yeah, do you have any concern about anything that's
No. Do you have a feel for what percentage of manuscripts that you accept and manuscripts that you reject? They just come in unsolicited to you?
Unsolicited stuff, it's about a 50-50. And most of what I publish is stuff that I go after. I know an author can do a particular thing, and I try to put together sort of a unified feel. For example, this Earth Stewardship. Stephen Peck's essay had come in through the personal essay contest, and James Goldberg had also come through. And then there were a few presentations in the last symposium that Rachel Amy Whipple did, and then I knew that that Mark Thomas was into green energy, so I sort of gathered those together. That's how I usually do it. It's like some things that have come in, some things that I put together. Yes, you go.
So, guest editors and special focus issues, is it something that will continue to happen, or?
Depends on people, if people like them. I've heard some people who really do like them, and other people say, yeah, so I'm not interested in environmentalism. I don't know, what's the...
You could always have special issues as long as the entire issue wasn't a special issue. In other words, if you can devote two-thirds of it, or half of it to a special issue, and then have enough for other people who may not be, who are looking for something that makes that justifies subscribing.
Yeah, and that's how I did the Earth Stewardship one, the motherhood one. I was rejecting material. It was like,
yeah.
I need another 50 pages.
Well, the reason why I ask that is because, you know, sometimes I have ideas, wild ideas about certain issues, you know, that perhaps could be a focus issue. I can share it with you, yes.
Do you read The Economist, or do you read The Economist so much?
I don't read them on a regular basis. I'm more of a New Yorker guy.
Okay, well, The Economist has surveys that will be, you know, in-depth treatments of something, it'll be covered, and it'll be, you know, 15 or 20 pages of dense text, and really an in-depth treatment. And it's in the center, and you can pull out, actually. You know, just the samples are there, and you can just pull out the center section. And then the rest of the magazine is consistent. They have their, you know, different business and finance, and
right.
Books and letters and whatever, right? So if you ever pick up an Economist, you know you're going to get a predictable set of information. And then maybe half of the issues have a survey or a special report that that can be pulled out. That's nice because you don't necessarily want to say every issue of Economist, but you might say, I'm going to say the surveys or this survey I'm interested in.
Well, that's interesting.
And I want to sit down with you because I have some other ideas along those lines that I'd like to discuss with you. But I think that that's the way to do it. If you have set columns that people look forward to and look for, whether it's arts and more arts and letters, or, you know, news from business of the church, corporate reporters, you have the consistent columns that people turn to, but then you have these pull-out sections that you have treatments.
Yeah, that's usually what happens. That's the default. We usually have the cornucopia column, and at the beginning, we used to have touchstones, but it didn't work out. But then we have like Jeff Burton's column, Mike Farnsworth's columns, and we've got the news, all of which are harmless for
everybody. I'm going to call you next week. We'll sit down. That's my answer.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Am I done?
We're going to call time here. Okay. You can reach. There are survey forms that are on the registration table. We will be here and available to talk to you throughout the session if anything pops in your brain between now and Saturday. And thank you for coming. Thank you for your input. Thank you for your questions. And
thank you all of you who make it work.